This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. State Democrats enjoying sustained electoral and fundraising success continue to go all Richard Sherman on poor Republicans, some of whom even protested a state visit from their own national party's chairman. The state's former Republican governor lost his bid to take his case to the Supreme Court, and Patriots fans can in part blame a man called Pot Roast for them not going to the Super Bowl. Those are just a few of the stories we'll tackle in this week's roundup of the news we call The Wheelhouse. Now, like any responsible public radio show, we have locally sourced our panel today because of the snowstorm we knew no matter what. Our own Colin McEnroe, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and WFSB Channel 3's Dennis House would all be able to make it here, and we're so thrilled to have them here today, along with the cameras of CTN. Welcome to everyone. Thank you so much for coming in.
Good morning.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. We're going to get to some of those stories in just a moment, but yet another bombogenesis has left Connecticut in its wake. And this latest episode of Snowmageddon has left a little bit more than a dusting in my town of Winsted, while other parts of the state got as much as a foot of snow. The storm left a lot of snow some places, very cold temperatures up and down the East Coast. I did see a tweet from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie last night in which he said, with no irony, he said that the speed limit on the New Jersey Turnpike had been lowered to 35 miles an hour, which I found amusing. But as we consider the storm, I think we have to start with you, Dennis House. You wrote on your blog, The Hartfordite, recently about your station's tradition of naming storms. This one, I see you named after the character Crazy Chester from the song The Wait by the band.
That's exactly what it was.
How do you come up with these names?
Well, the naming tradition began back when we were WTIC and based out of the old broadcast house in the late 1960s, early 1970s, as I am told. And it was one of those things. They started to do it, and it really caught on. Of course, back then, there were only three television stations. Channel 3 was extremely dominant, so everybody called it by that name. Each year, the meteorologists get together, and they come up with sort of a theme. A couple of years ago, we did famous people from Connecticut. There was Dennis Leary, Storm Dennis, things like that. This year,
that was the most famous person you could come up with?
Well, no, but they had to live in Connecticut.
Oh, they had to live in Connecticut.
And still, it's difficult. What do you want?
A Storm Merrill. I mean, I don't know.
And it's difficult because you have to go A, B, C, and switch the gender, things like that. So it's not as easy as you might think.
Okay. So you got to see this time around, and it's not Storm Colin.
It is not Storm Colin.
Could have been Dankosky, though.
Although that's a great idea for next year.
I think actually you should do that. What do you think about this idea, Colin? One television station gets to name the storms, and we all have to pick whether or not we're going to call it Chester or, as the Weather Channel calls it, Storm Janus or Janus, the Roman god of looking back and forward.
Well, actually, this practice that the Weather Channel now has of naming storms, which is a much newer practice, it actually started, I think, during Snowtober, as they called it in 2011. It should have been Snocktober. What are you going to do? And what's amusing to me about this is it's actually become pretty controversial at the national level. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration really hates this and protests it. They say it's bad science. It's not any science. I don't know how it could be bad science
whatsoever.
It's bad science, and it confuses people, and storms don't hit everybody the same way. So none of their complaints about this really make any sense. I mean, this is either a stupid or endearing habit that various media institutions have. But I don't understand. I mean, they actually sort of say, well, it puts lives in danger and it's bad science. And
I don't know how it puts lives in danger. I will say, though, that if the Weather Channel is coming up with Storm Janus, named after a Roman god, and you've got Chester, it seems like you maybe need to up your game or something. Like maybe there needs to be a slightly classier version of the next storm.
I have a theory as to why the Weather Channel started doing it. We had an intern, Eric Fisher, who's from Connecticut, who then went on to work around the country and ended up as a meteorologist at the Weather Channel. He's now at WBZ in Boston. So he was very familiar and had an inside seat to the naming process while he was an intern here. So I wonder if perhaps he suggested it to the Weather Channel while he was there.
So you think that maybe there's a Connecticut connection to this practice?
I believe it to be so.
I just very quickly, this: what's it like in a TV newsroom as one of these storms is approaching, as all the rest of us are trying to figure out, what's the news of the day, the weather's a part of it, you guys get taken over by the weather guys. I mean, is a lot of energy? I mean, how does it work exactly?
You know, when a storm comes in and they're looking at the radar, it's like porn to them. They're junkies. The weather people turn into these, they're committed to their craft. They love weather, and they love when these things happen. They love to report on them. This is what they live for.
I'm currently engaged right now. This is germane, sort of, in some online social media research. on the connection between people's weatherman preferences or weather person preferences, their favorite peanut butter and their favorite beetle. And I've got more than 300 responses already.
It's amazing.
And there's a slight Bob Maxson, GIF, John Lennon connection, but that's about as far as I'm willing to go right now.
If you want to call us up at 860-275-7266 and let us know who your most trusted weatherman is, your most trusted brand of peanut butter, and your favorite beetle, you can give us a call right now. You can also tweet us at Where We Live. I responded to you yesterday, Colin.
Yes.
I believe
you
the answer
the best
is Skippy.
Response. Yeah.
Skippy
you
to
the
all
best
three.
Response. Skippy in all three categories.
Well, let's move on to some other news here. Last week, thank you, Colin, for sitting in for me on The Wheelhouse. And I know you got into this a little bit, but you wrote about it in your column this Sunday in the Hartford Courant about state party politics. The Democrats in this state seem to be in control of everything. They almost are in control of everything, including the fundraising in the state, but yet they continue to beat away at Republicans in a way that you find, I don't know, maybe a little distasteful?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell when attack politics has moved into the distasteful realm, considering what attack politics is on a daily basis. But I mean, I think all of us have had this kind of sense, particularly in this election cycle, that what happens now, it's almost like a game of whack-a-mole. The minute some Republican sticks his or her head up long enough to announce, to say, I'm running for something, just this two-by-four comes down, really, really hard. And I mean, accusations of hypocrisy and mismanagement of whatever thing they've ever managed in their lives or that they're wrong and they're terrible and they're awful people. And it kind of crested a little bit, I thought anyway, recently. And a lot of times these things, which are coming out of the state's central party, they come out over the signature, so to speak, of Nancy DiNardo. They are not written by Nancy DiNardo. They do not contain the identifiable voice of Nancy DiNardo in any particular way. I regard Nancy DiNardo as something of a hostage right now. But but anyway, so in a lot of them, they just don't really sort of stand up. It'll say, you know, Tony Boucher and Mark Boughton, you know, attacked people who get unemployment insurance. And then they'll produce these quotes, which don't do that, actually. They don't support the statement. But anyway, most recently, this guy David Walker, who's of course, everybody knows who David Walker was because he was Comptroller General of the United States. I mean, every school child knows who the Comptroller General is. But anyway, for a long time, he was Comptroller General.
They named a storm after him, I think.
Yes.
They did.
Possibly owing to a blow into the head, he is now running for Lieutenant Governor. I don't know why he's doing this. But so anyway, he's like a fiscal policy nerd. And so somebody at our press conference was asking him some gun control questions, and he just didn't really have any answers. And he finally said, look, you know, I'm mainly a fiscal policy nerd. I'm paraphrasing. But I'm mainly a fiscal policy
nerd. That's
pretty
close.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, I certainly will look at gun control, and it's, you know, I know it's a very important, along with a bunch of other social issues, very important to other people, but it's not priority one for me right now. Somehow or other, that turned into a press release saying that he had insulted the people of Newtown and the survivors of the, I mean, he never mentioned Newtown or Sandy Hook or anything, but this turned into a press release from the Democratic Party saying that he had made callous and dismissive remarks about the Newtown shooting. So I don't know. Something snapped in me at that point.
Well, I was actually contemplating writing something. I would not have done so with the same zest and freedom that Colin can do on the opinion pages. But, you know, he's definitely onto something. I mean, some of it is there's been some new folks that have come on to the Connecticut Democratic Party. And they've come in with a much harder edge. Although I will say, the tone is new. The technique is not. John McKinney announced for governor on July 23rd. For 10 of the 11 following days, there were daily critical emails from the Democratic Party. All had the same thing. John McKinney is out of touch.
Well, so a question for you that I think a lot of our listeners might be interested in is what exactly do these sorts of political attacks target? Who do they target? You get these press releases every day, and as we've heard, there's this dwindling press corps that actually covers all things political in Connecticut. They don't go directly out to people. I mean, do they make news? Does it have any impact one way or the other, is I guess my question.
It's an attempt to get something rattling around the echo chamber. Most of these press releases have been ignored by the media because they're silly. I mean, the criticism of Walker for insulting Sandy Hook was just ridiculous on its face, and I don't believe anyone touched it with a 10-foot pole. The other purpose is some of these things are to kind of get the base a little jazzed up. Although, again, does the base really need to be jazzed up about the former Comptroller General of the United States.
Does the base need to be jazzed up when you're, by some counts, leading by 14-1 margin in fundraising, when you have all the statewide elected offices in control, when you have a supermajority in the House and the Senate of the state legislature?
This is taking the new mantra of politics to the nth degree, and that is define your opponent before he can define himself. So that's the impulse. It's just a silly version of it. I think they would be much better off if they would just focus on fact-checking, on highlighting actual things that these folks said and putting them out, instead of doing what, quite frankly, are bait-and-switch emails. You see these subject lines, and I go, oh, my God, David Walker said what? And then I open the email, and I find out it was something he said while standing 4 feet in front of me, and it wasn't what he had said at all.
And you don't remember this happening. So we've heard from—
Which is very disconcerting.
Yeah, I mean, this is called lying. I mean, a lot of these things are basically lies, and they ought to be called that.
We've heard from a columnist, and we've heard from somebody who writes the news on a daily basis trying to find some news from this. Dennis, you host a show kind of like Mine, Face the State. I mean, do any of these sorts of partisan attacks, do they mean anything to you? Any traction here?
Well— Yeah, I'm the same way as Mark. You look at them and you're like, wow, I need to read more of this. And there, I think the Democrats are hoping that perhaps some reporter somewhere in this state who perhaps is just starting out and doesn't have any experience is going to read that on the air verbatim. And I think often it does happen. And we've had some issues over the years where we have someone who's right out of college who's not that experienced writing a story. For instance, a high school will put out a press release saying, hey, we are number two in the state in this new Time magazine poll.
Yeah.
And that's how the script gets into the system. And the obvious question is, who's number one?
Yeah.
Because that number one school didn't send out the press release.
Sure.
So you sort of have to look beyond these press releases and find out whether it's true or false.
Yes.
I will say the Democrats do a great job of getting these things out. Everyone's talking about them every day in their newsrooms because they're sent out. The Republicans don't really do that. For instance, when Rush Limbaugh said something about – what was her name? Fluke, her first name.
Sandra Fluke. Mm.
There were all these press releases. Does Linda McMahon distance herself from him and yada, yada, yada. When Anthony Weiner went to run for mayor, there was nothing from the state Republican Party saying, hey, what does Governor Malloy think about him running? Things like that. So,
and the other part of the game is if somebody does pick up and write about it, then the party sends out a press release with links to that. And,
exactly.
And they're trying to get the rest of the press to go, see you guys, you're missing out. You know. Now, I will say the state Republicans are not doing it, but the congressional Republicans certainly are. And the most humorous vein is when they target Elizabeth Esty and Jim Himes, because those are the two districts that are considered most competitive. And into your email box will pop identical hit pieces, you know, just sub the name Himes for Esty. And that has its own comic effect.
We're talking today with Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Dennis House from WFSB. He hosts Face the State, and our own Colin McEnroe. You can join us at 860-275-7266. As we talk about some of the news of the week and talking about political parties in the state, we've been talking about the Democrats. Let's go to the Republicans here and bring in Melissa Bailey, who's managing editor of the New Haven Independent. We saw recently a big fundraiser at the Owl Shop. The Owl Shop is a great place where you can smoke indoors right in downtown New Haven, and they held a big fundraiser there, and Melissa covered this. Hi, Melissa. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks, John.
So, first of all, tell us who was exactly at this fundraiser that the Republicans held in downtown New Haven.
Sure. Well, on one side of the street, we had establishment Republicans lining up to pay $125 a head to smoke cigars with the National Republican leader, Reince Priebus. And so the event attracted a lot of lobbyists, elected officials from the Republican Party.
And then, meanwhile, across the street, there's a counter-protest. So Republicans are protesting Republicans raising money.
Yeah. So on the other side of the street, yelling across traffic are members of the Tea Party with signs, waving flags, denouncing their party leaders as hypocrites. And they're yelling things like, gun grabbers must go and defend the Constitution. And their top target seemed to be Senator John McKinney, who, as you said, is running for governor. And they accused him of breaking his oath to defend the Constitution by passing the gun control bill in the wake of Sandy Hook.
So the fact that they had the RNC chairman in town, did they fill up the room? I know Colin and I were thinking about going down there until I thought it was Prince who was coming, but it's Reince Priebus. did they fill the room? Did they raise any money for the RNC?
Yeah, I mean, they had certainly over 100 people there. It was pretty packed. The line was out the door at several moments in the day. So, yeah, they had a very steady stream of people going in there. But if you looked at the people across the street, they thought, you know, the smoky room was actually a symbol of the betrayal of the Republican Party platform.
Oh, dear. A metaphor, Paz.
We love those. We love those. And Melissa had great photos of the street theater. And that's what it was. It was great street theater. By the way, this pack is itty-bitty bit player in Connecticut politics.
This is the Leadership Connecticut PAC, yes. Right? This is what we're raising money for here.
And what it's really about is raising money to cover the travel expenses of two members of the Republican National Committee from Connecticut. They, in 2012, they gave away $10,500 to Republican congressional candidates in Connecticut. So, you know, that sort of gets lost here.
That's what we call bus fare.
No, exactly. They gave $5,000 in the fifth and $5,000 in the fourth, and then some of the long shots got $250. But that's the funny part. This, because the Democrats are raising so much money, and they're raising it from a lot of special interests. When this invitation went out to lobbyists and contractors who can legally give to this kind of thing, the Democrats said, see, they're doing the exact same thing. And they are, but it's just on a much – I mean, this is like comparing a single-A baseball team, you know, to the Boston Red Sox.
So, Colin, you know, last week you upset a lot of Democrats because you wrote about how the Democrats are being too mean to the Republicans. Then a few weeks ago you upset Democrats because you wrote all about how the Republicans should get their stuff together. A lot of people have been meaning to talk to you about this. But, I mean, what's your take on this as you call for the Republican Party of the state of Connecticut to maybe try to make a little bit more of a show of things? Here they have literally a smoke-filled room filled with you know, whatever party insiders there are, and the Tea Party is even protesting that. It seems as though the Republican Party of the state of Connecticut cannot get their stuff together.
You know, there's sort of a jargon term that I'm not especially fond of these days, optics. And I think the Republicans are showing themselves to be very, very bad at it. We're going to be getting into the subject of where they're having their state convention in just a second, which is also going to be really, really bad optics. This is bad optics, a smoke-filled room. I mean, everybody kind of understands what that is, playing sort of to the Rush Limbaugh cigar-smoking high-end crowd. And meanwhile, as Paz said, the photos were worth a thousand words. I mean, they really, the Tea Party people look like some kind of demented scout troop out there, you know. I mean, they really look like crazy people. And looking at the photos and reading the coverage, I just was thinking, none of these people are the people that you would like to turn the destiny of the Republican Party over to. I mean, neither the people smoking the cigars nor the people running around with, you know, flags with snakes on them or whatever. And I actually don't think the Republican Party is going to get its act together. We did a whole show on my show about a week ago with Jerry Labriola and three other prominent Republicans. And I don't feel it, you know. I mean, I think they have sort of an interesting opportunity here just because, in fact, I think – you know, Governor Malloy is a little bit out of communion with his own party, with unaffiliateds. But I don't see it happening. I don't see signs that this is a party ready to organize itself and get an effective message out.
I just want to quickly go back to Melissa Bailey from the New Haven Independent. Melissa, as you were covering this very interesting thing, what I found fascinating, too, not just the optics of the smoke-filled room versus the weird protest outside, but the fact that this is all happening in downtown New Haven, where you tend not to see a whole bunch of Republicans gathered in one place at one time, Melissa.
Yes. Yeah, it was one of the few political events I've covered here where I recognized almost no one.
Well, Skull and Bones was booked for the night.
Democratic, you know, New Haven, all our 30 legislators are all Democrats, so we don't know what a Republican looks like. But we had Democratic sort of activists who like to do street theater camped out in the middle of these two camps of Republicans just relishing this event. And they were saying, what, did you get lost on 95? What's going on?
Well, now that the Republicans left, you can get back to covering the normal sort of New Haven story, which is what kind of hybrid car will the new mayor of New Haven drive? Mm-hmm. That's the typical kind of thing that you get to cover in the New Haven Independent. Melissa Bailey, managing editor there and a great reporter and photographer. Melissa, thanks as always for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Hey, so Dennis House, but before we move on from this and we talk about where this party convention is happening, you actually had a little interchange with one of the few national Republicans that got a little bit of resonance and traction here. I didn't know Ann Coulter was from Connecticut.
She grew up in New Canaan. We always invite Connecticut people to come in to face the state when they're in the state. And she had a new book out, so we contacted or reached out to see if she was going to be doing a book tour in the state. She's not. And so they offered, do you want to do some Q&A? With email, because our policy at Face the State is you need to be in the studio. And we do that because some politicians would love to be in their office via satellite, and then they say, I can't hear you. And
I've faced some of these same problems, Dennis. Yes, indeed. Getting people into the studio. Yes.
They need to be here. And we've had some people who've refused to do it, and they end up losing that year because they just never would come into the studio, and their opponent came in numerous times.
Yes. And they had a storm named after them the following year.
Yeah, there you go.
Exactly. So what did Ann Coulter tell you over email?
Well, we asked her about the governor's race, and she said that she hopes Tom Foley wins, which led to a press release from the Democratic Party urging Foley to distance himself from that comment about her. But, she's Ann Coulter. She is what she is. She always says something very memorable.
So did Tom Foley have any sort of particular reaction to this?
No, I think Tom was actually unaware of it.
I mean,
there are several sort of classic forms of these silly press releases, and that's one of my favorites. So and so has, all she said, by the way, was, I'd like to see him win.
Yeah, it wasn't really an endorsement.
No, and now, will you accept the endorsement? I mean, it was.
You mean you don't think she really looked over Tony Boucher's voting record and stuff like that?
Hasn't got to it yet.
Dig in quite deep.
She called Senator Blumenthal repellent, as I recall.
She did.
Repellent.
Well, that is her stock and trade.
It is.
Being the provocateur.
It is. That's what she does. You know, we've had Mika Brzezinski come in and Rudy Giuliani, a few others who've been passing through the state. So you never know who's going to be here, and we extended the invitation.
Well, okay. So now I want to get into this last thing in this segment here. So we go from one smoke-filled room to potentially another smoke-filled room. It looks as though the GOP they're going to the gambling tables.
The Connecticut Republican Party is going to nominate its 2014 ticket at a casino.
Well, I mean,
now,
they make lots of money in the state.
You want to talk about optics of a bunch of people walking into a cigar bar. It is an invitation for folks to have all kinds of fun. I can only imagine, although there is controlled access to this place, so I guess that will cut down on what would be otherwise delicious street theater. But they're saving money by renting the convention center at the casino. But yeah, their statement is, hey, it's an important part of the Connecticut tourism economy, so we're going to go down there. It does get the convention out to Eastern Connecticut, where it hasn't been.
We have a women's professional basketball
team
there. I mean, it seems as though college.
Now, I have heard, though, that if you're a publicly financed candidate, you are going to be limited to $100 bets at the blackjack table.
Colin?
It is bad optics, and it's on the various stand-up shots that reporters from WFSB and elsewhere will be doing. It's just not going to look all that great. I don't know what else to say about it other than the one thing that it does sort of make me realize is I don't know where I've been when I've been at all the other Republican state conventions. I'm aware that I've sat in many hotel ballrooms with, Paz and Kevin Rennie and Walter Shapiro and watched various things unfold, but I don't really know where they were.
They were
in hotels somewhere, I think.
They were. I think the party has figured out that David Walker secretly is a card counter, and that's how they're going to really match the Democrats in raising money. And that's it. I'm done.
I think one of the things is if it doesn't go well for the Republicans, what happens at Mohegan Sun stays at Mohegan Sun.
Where do you say it is? Do you say I'm live at Mohegan Sun? Do you say I'm in Uncasville? I would have put it in Bridgeport.
Yeah.
Well,
or Hartford. I just think all political announcements should be there. Political events should be there because all the media is there. It just
all
seems
the
to make
there.
A lot of sense.
But you want to make things easy for the media, and I don't think that they necessarily do. We're talking with Dennis Allison from WFSB. He's host of Face the State. Mark Pazniokas is bureau chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Mark, Colin McEnroe is host of the Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR. And you can join us at 860-275-7266. When we come back, we'll be talking about former Governor John Rowland losing his bid to get his case to the U.S. Supreme Court and quite a bit more on The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's our news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We take a look at the news of the week with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, what's on the show today, Colin?
Actually, we are sort of re-airing a show we did about asteroid strikes, just to add to your good cheer after the bad weather and stuff like that. It's actually a pretty interesting show, though. And the reason we're doing this is because tonight we're at Watkinson School
Absolutely.
At 7 p.m. This is what I really want to promote for a show about the healing power of music. And we're going to have music by Jim Chapdelaine and the Kate Callahan band, and it's going to be a lot of fun. I don't know how many tickets are left, but contact Watkinson if you want to go.
Absolutely. Nice. And with all the weather and everything, this event is on tonight.
It's on. We are doing it.
You should absolutely go out there tonight. So Colin McEnroe at 1 o'clock, and then again at 7 o'clock tonight. You can find out more on WNPR.org. Mark Pasniokas is here, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Has a snazzy new redesign of the Connecticut Mirror today, Pass.
Thank you. Yeah, I would urge people to check it out. We actually listened to comments that we got after our last redesign, which a lot of people said, too busy. And anyway, we've simplified it a bit, and it allows us to do some things we couldn't do before.
You can check it out at ctmirror.org. And Dennis House is anchor for WFSB Channel 3 and also host of Face the State. You've got a snazzy new blog, The Hartfordite, Dennis. It looks really nice.
Well, you know, when I first started the blog, it was basically to promote Face the State, and it was just a simple thing I got off WordPress. And then the hits started piling up, and I said, you know what, I need to make it look a little bit better. So thank you very much. Just a quick little upgrade. But
Dennis also has a new line of jams and jellies that he's promoting on the blog as well. So he's too modest to mention it.
And clothing, too.
Now, yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court announced it would not hear an appeal by former Connecticut Governor John Rowland in a case surrounding his layoff of unionized state workers. Surprised by this, Colin, at all?
No, I think it was kind of unlikely that the Supreme Court was going to hear this appeal. What's sort of interesting now is sort of the next stage of this game. One of the things that I sort of neglected or had forgotten was there's two parts of this, and Paz could explain this so much better, but there's two parts of this case, one in which essentially the state was sued by the state workers. And this is all about the First Amendment. It's the right of association, basically. The notion being that the layoffs were – they targeted union members in a way that punished them for exercising their right of association. So there's one part of this that went against the state. But then another part of the case went individually against Governor Rowland and his budget chief, Mark Ryan. And what happened with that one – first of all, what has to happen there is either the attorney general has to defend them or the attorney general has to find somebody else to defend them. So the attorney general found somebody else to defend them. And what happened was that the lower court judge, Judge Covello, dismissed that part of the case, apparently in error. That dismissal has since been overruled. But this case has never been litigated on its merits. So one possible thing that may happen now, one option, one possible thing that may happen is that Governor Rowland and Mark Ryan, since they don't have to pay for their attorneys, could conceivably seek an actual trial on the merits of this case, of their part of this case.
Of their part of this case. Paz?
Yeah, although if the attorney general does reach a settlement, I'm guessing the governor and Mr. Ryan will be, the former governor and Mr. Ryan will be happy to
as long as they don't have to pay anything.
Exactly, and that is very rare for them to be on the hook for that. I mean, it is technically possible, which is why former Governor Rowland did have the right, independently of the state, to seek a review by the Supreme Court. And by the way, if Rowland and Ryan take it all the way through the U.S. District Court and lose, they still could take a shot at the Supreme Court because they're claiming there are some key managerial rights that are now in jeopardy as a result of the Second Circuit decision. You know, and this quickly goes into the weeds, but
key managerial rights, like the managerial rights of, say, the current governor to lay people off.
Yes. I mean, the short version of this, and this there's a lot of nuance here, but the Cliff Notes version is the fear by, you know, for example, the Connecticut Associated Boards of Education, which jumped on this as in an amicus brief, said, hey, this seems to send a message that you really can't use layoffs to pressure unions to come to the table and deliver concessions. Now, the union's attorneys say, no, that is not exactly it. It's really how Governor Rowland framed the debate, who he went after. And that's that's where there's great, great disagreement in this case as to whether or not Rowland's actions were punitive because these people were in the unions, or were they tactical, that this was his way to get them to the table.
Although some of that's now stipulated, too.
Yes,
you know?
Well,
I mean, some of it's not – that's not – I mean, this really – we are in the weeds here.
Well, yes. I think the bigger outside the weeds thing is, does this case in any way, Colin, do you think, have any way that might in the future change how – the executive branch of the state government deals with state workers, because essentially that is one of the things that the state always has over state workers. We need to cut the budget. We maybe need to cut the budget through some sort of series of layoffs. And now we're going to use that as a hammer in negotiations. Does this change anything about the way the state does business, essentially?
I think just that they're going to be a little bit smarter about it. I mean, really, it's not that hard to avoid the pitfall that they found themselves in. And the reason, in my humble opinion, that they're in this pitfall, that they're in this pickle, is because they were vengeful and they were punitive, and it was easy to illustrate that. Whereas, you know, with a little bit of sleight of hand, you could easily mask what you're doing. And I think future governors will just be a little bit smarter and a little bit less knee-jerk. I just also – the one thing I do want to say, the other lesson about this is that clearly now in the year 2028, our robot overlords are still going to be trying to unravel all of the messes that John Rowland got us into. This is just one of them.
Well, it's interesting because 20 years ago he was elected. 10 years ago he left office, and here he is dominating the headlines.
And here he is once again.
Again.
I hear he's got a radio show and another radio station.
I've heard that.
I've not listened to it. I want to move on to something that we've talked about for week after week after week, but you wrote about it on WNPR.org, Colin, again this past week, and I think it's important to bring up. You know, we had more audio now from the Adam Lanza case, but it wasn't the 911 tapes. It was this audio of him on an Oregon radio station, and we had quite some conversations about whether or not to air it or how to air it, how important it should be. And you wrote about this, and I think it's sort of an important conversation to have about what this may or may not tell us and how curious we still are about Adam Lanza and what he did and why he did it.
Yeah, I mean, but just to sort of set the stage here, this was a phone call made about considerably before the shooting, a couple of years before the shooting. It's to an anarcho-primitivist radio host in Oregon. I won't even try to explain what that means, but...
But listen, if you listen to the tape, you'll get a little,
sense of it. And I mean, the other thing to say is it really hasn't been established as gospel that this is Adam Lanza.
Absolutely not.
The case for the provenance has been made, I think, pretty well. The New York Daily News unearthed this. They played it for people who knew Adam Lanza. They also matched it up with an identity that he had on bulletin boards. And so, I mean, I think step one is, before we have too many other conversations about it, it ought to be nailed down. And that's something that the state is capable of doing. I don't know why in the report or the massive police data dump that followed that this wasn't addressed. Maybe they didn't know about it, although it was a fairly easy matter for the New York Daily News to figure this out. So, I mean, it ought to be nailed down whether it's him or not. And then after that, there is this whole other conversation. People like Hank Schwartz, mental health professionals, are really looking for more information about who this guy was. And there is some there. I mean, if you listen to the 7.5-minute call, There's some information there.
And we talked to the state. Our Jeff Cohen was talking to the state police. From what we heard from them, they're not sure that they're really looking into this. Sedensky, not really looking into this. And so the question is, are we going to learn anything more about this? How did you folks at Channel 3 handle this audio and this story, Dennis?
We did not run the audio over the weekend. It's one of those things, and I hate to say it, but there are a lot of viewers who are done hearing about Newtown, including some of the family members. I interviewed a couple family members in November, right before the anniversary. They don't blame Adam Lanza. They blame his mom. You know, they'll tell you bad parenting, and that's all they want to talk about.
Mm.
And much of this, while it's news, sometimes we choose not to run the actual audio excerpts from it. We did run the story.
It gets to this sort of question about how much more curious should the state police be in unearthing whether or not it's more details about this Paz or more details at all about Adam Lanza's life and his motivations. I mean, are we done with this now that the state police have essentially said we're done with this?
Well, I think there's a duty and a responsibility to go as deeply as you can any time you can explore what moves, you know, these mass murderers to act. And then the other issue is, you know, you always want to look not to cast blame, but to learn, to see what signs were missed. You know, were there folks who may have encountered him who can look back and learn and provide lessons to the greater mental health community, the education community, about, look, this is what we saw in this case. Now, also present in all these cases are incredible outliers, you know. So that is always going to be part of the debate. How much time do you want educational and mental health professionals to spend looking at, you know, a tiny piece of 1% of, you know, the mental health population.
And there was also a report last week that the FBI went to his house because he had hacked a computer a few years before or something like that.
Yeah. So.
Well, and I think just the last thing on this, Colin, is we have this ongoing mental health conversation. This ongoing Sandy Hook Commission continues to hear testimony. They talk about and they talk openly about the fact that the diagnosis that we do know that Adam Lanza has, that is of Asperger's syndrome, which is on the autism spectrum, is not likely to cause Adam Lanza or anybody else to be particularly violent. It seems as though that's an important part of this, that as we listen to this tape, which may or may not be Adam Lanza, that we learn a little bit about what motivated him and what perhaps didn't motivate him. The only diagnosis out there has to do with Asperger's syndrome, and a lot of parents of kids with Asperger's syndrome are saying, wait, this is not something that makes my kid violent.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think everything that's been, I agree with everything that's been said here so far. But I mean, I think the state needs to speak with one voice of this, back to Storm Janus. You know, I mean, on the one hand, if we're going to have a task force chaired by Scott Jackson, the mayor of Hamden, to look into this long term, that suggests a real deep curiosity about this.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's at odds with the state police, you know, lack of curiosity about something like this audio. And in this audio, Adam Lanza does talk about why he thinks Travis the chimp, this gets so bizarre, I just apologize, but why he thinks Travis the chimp was tipped into a mode of violence. And then he analogizes between that and people who show up and do shootings in movie theaters and things like that. So, I mean, it's not off point. You know, it's right on point. So I guess I'm having trouble reconciling the idea that we are interested to the point of convening this task force, but not interested to the point of almost indifference by the investigative authorities in something as germane as this audio.
We're talking with Colin McEnroe and Mark Pazniokas and Dennis House today in The Wheelhouse. It's our weekly look at the news each Wednesday here on WNPR's Where We Live. You can join us 860-275-7266. If you haven't been to the state capitol in a while, you might be surprised by the latest news that the capitol will soon require visitors to pass through metal detectors, something that State Representative Ernest Hewitt has been in favor of for years now. Here's Hewitt speaking on WNPR's Morning Edition last year.
People hear me talk and they say that, you know, Hewitt wants to protect himself. You know, there's a lot of people in that building. We have New York that has metal detectors. You have Massachusetts that has metal detectors. And we're sitting here in between and we're saying, okay, it's the people's building and we don't need them. Well, guess what? Those people that come to that building, they're the people too.
So, Paz, you've been going in and out of this building for years and years. What do you think of this?
I'm really saddened by it, which I think a lot of legislators are. It does say something about our society. It does create a psychological barrier to people coming in and out of the building. Unfortunately, if I was one of those legislators and the chief of the State Capitol Police Department came to me with a security assessment and a threat assessment and pointed out that Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, Massachusetts all have metal detectors, I would have been hard-pressed to say no thank you.
And a lot of your kids' schools have metal detectors, and you go to the mm-hmm. you know the airport and they have metal detectors, and it seems to be a part of life today and something that maybe we shouldn't shield the people's building, the state capitol, from.
You know, that's true. But even the architecture of the capitol and legislative office building is meant to promote a sense of transparency and access. They're all built around these great atriums, and you literally can stand at the rail on one floor and kind of look and see what's going on, who's talking to whom. And it makes it a nice place to work as a journalist. But again, it's you know, part of the concern was the staff, you know, not just post Newtown, but at different times it's the staff that, you know, they'll have people who suddenly appear before them, you know, who might be a little off and say, I want to see so-and-so. And there's a lot of uncomfortable encounters like that.
And try to get through those uncomfortable encounters is important. Dennis?
It is very sad. I took the kids to Statue of Liberty the end of last year, and you go through two metal detectors, one before you get on the ferry, second one as you enter the statue, and it is sad. This is just the way life is right now. Mayor Tony Harp has threats against her. Governor Malloy has threats that they won't talk about, but look at the security around him compared to Governor Rell. It's been beefed up. There's so much we don't know. I don't have a problem with it. You go to Washington, D.C., you have to go through metal detectors.
Should we be sad, Colin?
Yeah, we should be sad. And it's also going to be, on certain days, a tremendous nuisance. I mean, you know, if you go to the courthouse on a busy day,
yes,
you can be stacked up out on the street for a while. And yeah, there are going to be days where all of us just have a lot of trouble getting in there. You know, there have been sort of, as passive, kind of wacky people at the Capitol. Some of them actually were office holders. But And we had a guy, when the guy would cut his finger off, you know, and then send it back into the building. And I mean, we had this for a long time, but we're living in a new normal. This is a different age. And
the legislators will not be screened, by the way.
The legislators will not be screened?
No.
Big mistake.
That's interesting.
Legislators, staff, people with General Assembly issued IDs are going to be able to bypass the metal detectors.
I want to know what the status of the plastic gun legislation was of the federal government, too. You know, the guns that – eventually there will be guns that will beat the metal detectors, mm-hmm. but, I mean, a la John Malkovich.
Right.
And then what?
Right. Well, but I mean, like, for those of us who work in the building full-time in the press room, you know, we carry computer bags, cameras, digital recorders. If we had to go through that every day – and there are some days we're in and out of that building many times.
Yeah.
So they're trying to accommodate the people who work in the building. But we'll see if that becomes an issue as well.
When we come back from our break, we're going to rapid fire through a few more stories that we want to make sure that we get to by the end of our show today, including the pot roast, a local guy made good who helped keep the Patriots out of the Super Bowl. You can join us here on Where We Live as we continue in the Wheelhouse right after this. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, last week, a federal court struck down an FCC regulation that said Internet service providers could not favor one website or service over another. We'll be talking net neutrality on the show. We'll also be telling a story about a Hartford man smuggled out of Czechoslovakia just before World War II. It's a fairly amazing story that Diane Orson will bring us on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Colin McEnroe from WNPR, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Dennis House from WFSB all join us here. We're going to rapid fire through a few quick stories, including one you wrote about just the other day, Paz, one that we've talked about quite a bit on the show today. It's a showdown between a local bicyclist and the DOT over the busway, or is it now called CT Fast Track?
Yeah, Chris Brown, who his transportation exclusively is his big, heavy cargo bike he rides around Hartford. It's literally the bicyclist who took on City Hall or the DOT in this case. It does not look like he's going to prevail. At issue was the closing of a street that Colin and I are very familiar with, Flower Street. It runs behind the Hartford Current and the Aetna. And this was a big route for Chris. It was shut down to accommodate the busway. He was able to involve himself in a hearing process. Ironically enough, the court said the other day, that the commissioner of DOT actually didn't even need to hold this hearing process, and they said he was being a nice guy. And anyway, make a long story short, there was an order by a DOT hearing officer to provide access for bicyclists and pedestrians during construction and then have a permanent bridge afterwards, and there was a suggestion that the Flower Street not be closed until this bridge is complete. That's not going to happen. So Chris Brown was in court looking for a writ of mandamus to force the commissioner to abide by his hearing officer's order.
Well, look, and Chris Brown is someone who calls our show regularly. Ken Krajewski, his lawyer, is someone who calls our show quite frequently. One thing that's just very quickly interesting about this, Paz, and again, we've covered this topic a little bit on our program. The argument that's being made is it's very dangerous for bicyclists, Chris Brown says, to take this new route that you have to go around, not just bicyclists, but pedestrians. Essentially, people's lives will be at risk, he says, when you have to go by the highway on-ramp in order to get from one part of town to the next.
Right. The DOT says it would be even more dangerous to be cutting across both a construction site and eventually a working busway where they're supposed to have these things zip by every 5 minutes. And that's the counterargument. I did learn something yesterday. It is legal in the city of Hartford to ride a bike on the sidewalk. I was under the impression that was a no-no. And the judge and DOT suggested that Chris take the sidewalk on Broad Street.
And actually take the sidewalk, which is not something bicyclists normally want to do or think that they can do in most other places. Colin, I want to ask you quickly about something that happened since last week's show. Dan Esty, who we've had on this program like 1,000 times, the state commissioner of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, says he's stepping down. Some people hailing this, other people saying they're never going to get another Dan Esty. What do you think of the job Dan Esty's done?
You know, I think on balance, you have to give him credit. I had my doubts initially going in, and it certainly isn't an unblemished set of accomplishments. But, you know, in sort of actually developing an energy policy for Connecticut, which effectively I don't think we really had before.
There wasn't
this
one before, yes.
You know, I think if you look at some of those sort of fusion things that he did, I will go to my grave thinking that some of his ideas about partnership between business and environmental regulation need to be preceded by a climate of actual environmental enforcement, which I don't think we ever had in Connecticut. But, you know, first of all, we knew this was going to happen one of these days. He was going to go back to Yale, and I think you have to sort of tip your hat.
And I think one of the battles we're going to look at, Paz, is whether or not the folks on the environmental enforcement end of that department or the folks on the energy end of the department, who's going to end up in the power seat. I have a feeling that in the Malloy administration, I know which side is going to be more in the advantage
and,
role.
And but, I rarely do shameless self-promotion, but look at our site, ctmir.org. Jan Spiegel has a good discussion just of that. About trying to restore that balance or to what extent it should be restored.
I have to ask you, Dennis, you spoke in your most recent Face the State program with the new Archbishop of Hartford, Leonard Blair. What did he tell you? What did you learn?
Well, that he was confused when he first moved here. People were talking about Yukon all the time, and he thought they were talking about Alaska.
They were talking about a place with sled dogs.
Well,
and
Huskies, you know.
The Huskies. Yeah. They're Huskies there, yes.
But he's much like Archbishop Mansell. I don't think as forceful. Maybe that will happen over time. But he obviously talked about abortion, and politicians who support abortion rights who are Catholic should think twice before they get communion. He weighed in on the Yukon controversy, the Jesus in the Huddle controversy, saying that there is room for God and we shouldn't be in a situation where there's no talking of God. What else?
Only if you
about?
Send a running back off the field.
He was later trumped then by women's basketball coach Gino Auriemma, who laid down the law about this, it seems. Yes.
Exactly, exactly. He talked about the future of the church and the state, declining membership, things like that, you know, the declining number of parishioners. We talked about church closings. He said he doesn't foresee any right now, but who knows?
Did he talk about that time that you dressed up as a priest in high school? There's pictures on his website, The Hartfordite, if you want to find out more about
it. I did. I dressed up as a priest in high school. I went to Catholic school. That's what you did.
That's what you did. Pazniokas isn't so sure about
you
this.
You love to stir it up.
So in the last couple of minutes we have, Colin, I know you threw this out here. Let's just give a little listen to the AFC championship game here.
Low snap, Brady, pressure, and he's taken down. Terrence Knighton.
Yes, Terrence Knighton. I didn't really know who Terrence Knighton was before this, Colin.
No, it's sort of odd. I mean, I think he's kind of, for the average person not on the sports writing staff of the Hartford Courant, he's kind of flown under the radar a little bit. I mean, he's a local hero who nobody knew that much about. Actually, at one point they said he played his football, high school football in the Hartford area, and I said, he did? And I looked it up. He played for Windsor High School. They said he was a wide receiver, which seemed very unlikely. And
yes,
in fact, I think he did play both ways, as they say, and he was a tight end, which is a little bit more plausible. He's known as Pot Roast because he, in certain ways, resembles one.
And that's one of the things that I heard. I didn't know about him. And then when they said his nickname was Pot Roast, I thought it seemed like the sort of person that we should actually have known a little bit more about. Did you know about this local sports like legend now?
No. The last local name that's kind of creeped into my subconscious was Tabucky Jones, I think.
Well, that's right.
For a whole bunch of reasons,
yeah, exactly.
I must
say.
Well, I sit near the sports guys, so I kind of knew about it.
So you actually knew about this?
Yeah.
Are there any other Hartford players who are in the NFL right now that we should know about, Dennis? Anybody else that I had no idea about Terrence Knighton?
You had to ask at 10 o'clock in the morning for my second cup of coffee.
Donald Brown from UConn is still with the Colts.
Of course he is.
That's right.
And how about Dwight Freeney? Is he still in the NFL?
And Dan Orlovsky is still around.
Yeah.
Who's he with now?
He's a journeyman backup quarterback.
No, he's not with Houston. I forget who he's with.
Okay. We'll get emails about this.
He's bouncing around, though.
Well, and the last thing I'll ask you, Dennis, you know, whenever you come in here, we tell you that it's going to be on television. The cameras of CTN are here, but you dress down. You used to, you know, wearing a suit and everything else. You got a hat on in case anybody sees this picture. What's the hat for?
The hat is for Matt Brown, who was a high school player in my hometown of Norwood, also Mark Pazniokas' hometown. He was paralyzed in a hockey hit. And so they had a fundraiser at Fenway Park. The Red Sox, it became such a cause celeb in that area that the Red Sox allowed their logo to be used with the M and the B next to it. So.
It's a very nice hat, supported by Dennis House, anchor for WFSB and host of Face the State. Dennis, always good to see you. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks for being here.
You can check
thanks for having me here.
His blog, The Hartfordite. Mark Pazniokas, the Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. You can check him out at ctmirror.org. Always good to see you, Paz.
Always good to see you.
And Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. You've got a few seconds left. Tell him about this thing again at 7 o'clock
tonight,
Colin.
The Healing Power of Music. It's about music, how music is used now in really kind of medical environments. We'll have a neuroscientist, a music therapist, and two musicians who attribute music to their own recovery from really, really catastrophic conditions.
And this is an indoor performance?
Indoor performance.
Indoor performance at the Watkinson School. This is tonight. We'll put more information on our website, WNPR.org. Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives produce our program. The executive producer is Katie Solarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.